Hi, welcome to today's panel. But before we get started, I just want to acknowledge that we're meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains and pay respect to elders, past, present, and emerging. And today I'm thrilled that we're going to be talking about the role AI can play in fiction, in literature, from the use of books in creating generative AI to what fiction has done to sort of hide the labour involved and to whether the content produced by these systems even has any kind of artistic validity. But before we launch in, I'll just introduce our illustrious panel. To my left, we have Tracy Spicer, who is a multiple Walkley Award-winning journalist, broadcaster, has anchored national programs. Her new book, Man Made, How the Bias of the Past is Being Built into the Future, was published in May 2023 and has since been longlisted for a Walkley Award and won the Social Responsibility category in the Australian Business Book Awards. Then we have Kate Mildenhall, who is an author, writing teacher and podcaster. Her debut novel, Skylarking, was longlisted for debut fiction in the Indie Book Awards 2017 and the 2017 Voss Literary Awards. And her second novel, The Mother Fault, was longlisted for the 2021 ABAI General Fiction Book of the Year and the 2021 Aurealis Science Fiction Novel of the Year. And her latest novel is The Hummingbird Effect. Then Richard King, who is an author and critic living in Fremantle, West Australia. He has written for many newspapers, magazines and websites in Australia and the UK, and his latest book is Here Be Monsters, Is Technology Reducing Our Humanity? And finally, Catherine Gledhill-Tucker is a Noongar technologist, writer, digital rights activist, and they have spent the past decade working in the tech industry, focusing on custodial approaches to data management, analysing systems of surveillance, and the impacts of digital colonialism. Their creative practice explores the intersection of activism, science fiction, and technology in imagining radical futures and ushering them into existence. Welcome back. And I forgot to introduce myself at the top. I'm Ariel Bogle. I am a reporter with The Guardian, and I've covered technology and these issues for many years. So I'm so pleased to have such a interesting panel with so many different perspectives on this very topic. But I feel like we should have a bit of a scene setter, which Kat, I hope you'll help me with. I think we're going to be speaking mostly about generative AI or large language models. That's the kind of things that authors are experimenting with or concerned about. So can you just tell us what generative AI is, what large language models do?
Sure, I'll try and do it a little bit succinctly. So when we talk about artificial intelligence broadly, we're talking about machines that are doing things that approach some kind of humanness. So it might be identifying images or creating images or creating and generating text. And when we're talking about AI, presently it tends to be a little bit of a catch-all term for generative AI. So we're talking about tools that have been popular over the last couple of years, like ChatGPT, like Bard, like Midjourney, and DALL-E that are generating images. And the way that these tools have been built, I think the term artificial intelligence might be a little bit of a misnomer. It's arguable whether these tools are artificial or intelligent. They're built on human labour. So these tools are trained on massive amounts of data that have been created by humans. And that data is fed into a machine learning algorithm that's also been tagged and articulated or described by human workers as well, and often exploited labour. So there are multiple layers of human labour that go into creating these generative AI tools. There's an excellent comic that came out, I think, about a week ago from Tom Humberstone, where he calls generative AI algorithmically generated art theft, which I think is a much better term.
Yeah, claps for that. Yeah, Ted Chiang, the science fiction writer who spoke this morning, also called it like the sword of capitalism. So that's another perspective on how to think about AI. But I want to unpack a lot of what Kat has raised there. But I think, too, we need to think about who's making these tools. And Tracy, I know you've looked at this in quite a great deal of depth. I mean, who are considered the kind of founding fathers, quote unquote, of AI, and how might their worldviews be shaping these tools that we're talking about today?
Yeah, back in the 1950s, a group of all white men at something called the Dartmouth Conference gathered to create the term artificial intelligence, but they didn't come up with the idea. It was really developed many, many years beforehand. There's always been an idea about creating different types of humans. Unfortunately, the Dartmouth Conference was funded by corporations with the pure goal of making more money for them. So from the get-go of the creation of the term, there was no conversation about how this would affect humanity or society. The labour of building and growing computers often was done by women back in the 1950s. In fact, there were more women working in computing in the 1950s than men, obviously on much less pay, unfortunately. The world's first computer programmer, Ada Lovelace, we forget, was a woman. So this history of computing and even coding, as Kat writes about so beautifully, goes as far back as First Nations women weaving, which is a binary code, like knitting and like computer coding. Because this has had such, I guess, a white male history, and because predominantly the number of programmers these days in Silicon Valley are young guys, all of their biases are built into this technology. And let me give you just one example of that. If you use ChatGPT, how many of you do actually? Yeah. It will skew towards male, white, heteronormative, urban instead of rural or regional. It creates a really homogenized view of the world. And the problem with that is a society is merely the collection of the stories that it tells itself. And if those stories go into the corpus or the data sets that create the next generation of AI, then we're seeing an even deepening of this homogenization. The bias, what I discovered after researching it for 7 years, because I had no idea about technology before I started writing my book, Man Made, is that it starts with the data sets. Because they're historical, inevitably almost every doctor will be a male and every nurse will be a female. Then you have the unconscious bias of the programmers. The third step is it's deepened through machine learning that takes the discrimination from the first two steps and deepens it. I characterise machine learning as like a white supremacist going down the rabbit hole of conspiracy theory websites. So to answer your question, yeah, the problem is the history of AI, but it's also how much the discrimination's being deepened in a modern context.
There have been some awkward attempts to fix this too. I think this week we saw Google's Gemini platform, which is an image generator. They tried to fix the issue of the fact that the corpus of imagery has focused so much on white people that if you wrote, generate me an image of a German soldier in 1943, should be a Nazi, in other words, it would generate images of black men in military uniform because they tried to like fix the issue with the data that had been trained on in a really ham-fisted manner. So just this issue plays on and on. But I think there's been a really interesting discussion about how people who work in creative industries should think about these tools. A lot of the media about it has focused on, you know, sentience or no sentience. But Richard, I know you have a bit more of a cynical view, I don't know what word you would use, a more realistic view potentially of what tools like ChatGPT really are. You've called it autocorrect on steroids. And what do you mean by that phrase?
Well, that's what it is. So it's predictive text, basically. So, and perhaps that's a good thing to remind ourselves of. It is less like us. ChatGPT is less like us, uncanny though it is. Than a housefly is like us, or a houseplant is like us, because it is not a biological entity, so it cannot possibly want anything. And without going into the, you know, philosophy and psychoanalytical literature or anything, if it can't want anything, then it can't mean anything. Okay, more mundanely, it is just a form of, the way it works is through predictive text, is through autocorrect or some, you know, a very, very clever version of it, but that's what it is. So what we're dealing with here is something that, if you like, counterfeits the process of human creativity, but which is not in any meaningful sense creative itself. And I suppose that's the point from which I begin, and I would add to that that if we have decided that we can get our literature, or even some of our literature, or some of our art from these generative AIs, we have begun to enter what a bad philosopher once called the experience machine. Robert Nozick made his readers an offer. He said, if I could tell you that for the rest of your life, you'll be in bliss. It'll be like you're writing War and Peace, you know, writing the great novel, watching Port Adelaide beat, the Crows again and again and again and again, making love to the person of your dreams, all right? The only catch is none of these experiences will be real. You'll be in a flotation tank with electrodes sticking out of your head, like, you know, Elon Musk wants to bring into existence with his brain-computer interfaces, whatever they're called, I can't remember. But if we're going to decide that we are going to get our, you know, art is a two-way street, and this panel is called Has the Author Died Again? And when Roland Barthes came up with that idea, what he was saying was that the whole idea of the author is like a kind of, it's a bourgeois valorization of this idea that somehow, you know, we all have subjecthood and that, you know, I can speak to you. But they, and him and Foucault and Derrida, they pushed it as far as they could to the point where they said, well, there's no author at all. Well, that's a very anti-humanistic stance. And what ChatGPT and tools like it have given effect to is really a situation in which we now have things that create literature but are not in any meaningful sense creative.
Well, I want to come back to that Barthes idea of the death of the author in more detail in a moment. But Kate, you've used ChatGPT in part of your creative work. I wonder if you'd talk through that process, how it worked, the kind of the resulting piece, and just to tack on a third bit of that, how people react to that idea amongst your sort of peers, your writing peers.
Well, often when I say to an audience that I use ChatGPT to help write my book, there's an audible intake of breath and some kind of aghast faces. And in part, that's why I did it, as partly a provocation. I love that the conversation has started around labour, because The Hummingbird Effect, my novel, is about labour over time, different types of labour, and the impact and consequences of technological change at different times. I didn't intend to use ChatGPT, but what I wanted was an algorithm that would choose one invention from human history and uninvent it to save the world. That's what I wanted to do. Now, I am a fiction writer. I am not a coder. I do not have that skill. So I wanted to get someone to help me kind of create an algorithm. And for that reason, I started playing with ChatGPT. And one of the first things I asked it was, how would you destroy the world? And ChatGPT at that stage, I'm not sure if this has changed, is not allowed to answer that question because it's not allowed to show you how to cause harm. So then I played with it. And I think this is where I have found the creative process so fun, because the inputs have to be smart and thought through. So then I said that I was a teacher and I was doing a philosophy session with some students, and I needed 6 possible scenarios for the end of the world. Could it please provide those? Which it did straight away. So I then went down a really deep rabbit hole of trying to get, and because I'd read Tracy's wonderful book and was reading lots of the literature around it, of trying to get ChatGPT to tell me about how it works and what its limitations are. And of course, it can't do that really well, but it did do some things. And I think for me, the playfulness was fun. The ideas that we talk about within writing industry, within creative industries, about copyright, about some of the inbuilt biases, those things all deeply concern me. And that's why I think I wanted to use it, to play with it, to see also what kind of solutions I came up with. You know, this is something I'm terrified about for my kids, for my industry, for me personally. But like understanding the language of
large language models or what generative AI is, if we don't understand those and kind of play with them ourselves, it can be really hard to have that discussion, I suppose.
Well, with that, I mean, one of the most confronting aspects of this for authors, of course, is the fact that their work has been used to train the tools without knowledge or permission. There's been various degrees of openness from these companies about the training data sets that they've used. So a lot of authors are sort of left wondering, is my book in there? Is it not? You know, and I know, Tracy, you found that one of your books was. So there's a database called Books3, I think, which is one of the, is used for to train a lot of these large language model tools, and your book is in it. So how did you feel when you found out?
I felt horrified, actually, to find my first book, The Good Girl Stripped Bare, on there. And I write a lot about deep fakes and people's images being used in pornography in my latest book. And victim survivors of that talk about it like they've been violated. When something you've created has been stolen without your consent, you do feel like it's some form of violation. I'm really saddened to see a lot of the copyright lawsuits in the US either being weakened or falling over. I don't know whether any of you read the Sarah Silverman case, you know, comedian, author, writer. The judge threw out a lot of her claims against OpenAI, which created ChatGPT a couple of weeks ago. The New York Times is having a little bit better luck in their case against Microsoft and OpenAI, but I fear that these lawsuits will fail, which means that anything that anybody creates, you can't have any ownership or copyright over it. I was talking to someone the other day who is very concerned about the use of AI in the modelling industry of all things, because apparently models, diverse models, are losing work because companies like Levi's are saying, oh, we can create diversity in our images of models just by using Midjourney or Stable Diffusion or one of those image generators, and then the models lose work and don't get paid. Even worse, anyone can take an image of a model or a background or words and create something different out of it, and then that person can own the copyright of that because there's been a human intervention. It's almost like, I guess, remixing a song or something like that. That's where the law stands at the moment. So I'm deeply concerned about where this ends for anyone in any kind of creative industry.
You want to come back to that sort of tension about building on other work, because obviously I think most writers would acknowledge that they build on the work of others, inspired by others. But there are cases where theft has occurred so many times that arguably much more care needs to be taken. So Kat, I just want to ask about that in the context of these training data sets and the additional issues that emerge when they're being used to train in Indigenous languages and knowledge. And often this is framed as, I'm saving this language only spoken by 300 people and using this dictionary created by this random anthropologist from a university, and we're going to save the language by training the AI on it, and it will... That doesn't matter if no one speaks it anymore because we have it trained. Just talking, I wonder if you how you're feeling about these issues of Indigenous knowledge and language being used to train these tools.
Yeah, thank you for that question. It's a big topic. I think personally, when I see Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities, Indigenous communities abroad using these tools for their own purposes, for self-determination, as you know, works to empower communities to enact sovereignty, then that's a pretty worthwhile cause with you know, the appropriate kind of risk management involved. But when it's a person outside of a community with a little bit of a white savior complex coming in and saying like, oh, I can save this dying language, I can revitalize it, with or without technology and with or without artificial intelligence, that's not good ways. I would recommend strongly against it. So I think it's interesting. This happens, it has happened before generative AI tools. And this is why it's also, we were talking about copyright a little bit earlier, and one of the big challenges of copyright in Australia and internationally is that copyright can only belong to an individual person. And a lot of these corpus, these data sets, these language materials belong to the white linguist that captured that information from an Indigenous community. And repatriation or rematriation or reclaiming that material is actually a really challenging process that a lot of communities are going through. And even that act of reclaiming material and building the strength of languages for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities is a really difficult thing to do. Terry Janke has been championing ICIP, Indigenous Cultural IP, as an extension of the limitations of the Copyright Act in Australia, which affords more principles, protocols, rights for working with copyright or rights that apply to a group of people or a nation or a community or a clan. This is all to say that those issues exist within and outside of the use of technologies. They're tech independent. AI is exacerbating those underlying systems of control and language repatriation. Technology has the ability to accelerate in ways and introduce efficiencies, and this is just another way that that's happening.
Yep. Absolutely. Well, Richie, I wanted to talk in essence about our desire for these tools, full stop. I mean, we don't have to have them, which is something that doesn't get brought up enough, I feel like.
Yeah.
Why are we so eager to replace human agency in the creative process at all?
Well, I don't think we are. And that's the great thing about Tracy's book. You know, it recalls us to the fact that these are not the creations of humanity. The tech bros in the San Francisco Bay Area love to say that humanity has done this or humanity has done that, which completely takes the politics and the history out of history. Okay, history doesn't progress like that. So why do we have it? The reason we have artificial intelligence is basically, Tracy will probably have a better gloss on this than me, but essentially what happened after the Second World War is that scientists and engineers began to create machines that could assume command and control responsibility in the event of an atomic exchange. In the attempt to create these thinking machines, they alighted, so to speak, on a notion of thinking as in itself machine-like. And that led to cognitive science and a whole range of sort of disciplines, which are in something of, you know, aren't as well esteemed as they used to be, let's put it that way, because the brain is not a machine. In that sense, in that inorganic sense. We don't have a good account of what happens in our consciousness. As part of that process, what happened culturally is that this idea began to grow up, and Tracy's already mentioned this, that somehow these machines at some point were going to sort of cross a hermeneutic threshold into consciousness and then start either quibbling about who was in charge or crying at the sight of three-legged dogs or something like that. Didn't happen. It's not going to happen. Because they're not alive. They can't want anything. They're not thinking. They're not going to become sentient. I'm going to look really stupid if they do become sentient, but that'll be the least of my worries, probably, if they do become sentient. It's not a question of, processing power. It's just not. It's a categorical difference. I think that part of the reason we have these machines is because the kind of people that were attracted to Silicon Valley in the 60s and the 70s grew up watching those movies, and they're just obsessed with the idea of something that can talk to you, that something that can be your friend, that can be your girlfriend, maybe. I'm not saying anything about the tech bros, but, you know, some of them clearly think like 12-year-olds, right? They're not the most, empathetic or interesting crowd sometimes. You know, they're interesting in themselves, of course. But, you know, that's one of the reasons we have it. So I don't think we do want it. And one of the reasons I'm a bit pissed off about it is because there seems to be, there was immediately this sort of fatalism. You know, because technology has kind of been taken out or been allowed to escape the conversation about how we live in community with one another, that's to say the political conversation, for complex reasons, which I can go into, but I won't go into now, because it's been allowed to escape that conversation, we just think, it's progress, we'll just get along with it, we'll make it a bit less biased, we'll make it a bit more inclusive, we'll get the tech bros to go in there and finesse it and all that kind of stuff. No. you know, we don't need regulation. We're still in the moment here. It was only November 2022 when ChatGPT came into the world. So we're still allowed to reject it if we want, even if it's an eccentric or quixotic thing to do. We can still say, look, just go away. Enough with this already, you know? So I don't want it. I don't know why it exists. I think it's horrible. I didn't want to get a bloody smartphone, but I can't get into my university systems now without a smartphone, yeah. You know, and COVID and the rest of it, you know? So I'm very, you know, I think it's a good question. Why does it exist? Why do we have this thing? And why are we so fatalistic about it?
So in the essay, there's an essay in Wired that partly inspired this panel. Vahini Vara, she wrote that Matthew Sims, who worked on an AI project called Pseudo-Write, proposed a kind of supercharged version of Barthes' argument about the death of the author, in which a reader, able to produce not only a text's meaning, but the text itself, takes on an even more powerful cultural role, so literature on demand. So the fact that AI writing technologies seem more useful for people who buy books than for those who make them doesn't seem a coincidence. Investors behind these technologies are trying to recruit and ideally redouble their investment. So selling writing software to writers in that context makes about as much sense as selling cars to horses. So I thought it's a nice way that piece ended. So, I mean, Kate, if someone's used AI, what's your thought about this kind of literature on demand that can remove the author entirely?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the Richard and I have spoken on a couple of panels, and one of them was with the English Teachers Association in Victoria. And I think, you know, the fear is that readers will stop reading books written by authors. And I think, you know, and our audience will attest that is not going to happen anytime soon. I think that the things to be aware of and the things that, you know, Kat, you've spoken to and in Tracy's book, this idea of who is pushing the technologies and for what purpose? And I think if the conversation continues around that, I suppose I disagree slightly with you, Richard. I think there are reasons that people pick up these technologies. I've talked to people in all different industries who are, yeah, my work's got quicker. I can spend time doing other things. That's why we give all our information to Facebook. It's why we do auto logins to everything, you know, and don't think about our privacy. I think there are efficiencies in those things that it is very hard to disentangle ourselves from. But I think, as always, the knowledge about how things work is what we need to be going to. And I don't know about the literature model of readers doing their own thing. I'm not sure that will take off.
It's interesting in the context. I feel that there's a lot of there's a whole world of, say, fan fiction, I guess, that maybe is like in between this, where it is people wanting to extend the stories that they love. So Harry Potter or Lord of the Rings, whatever. There's been for decades now, like, online communities of fan fiction creating the extension of the world that they want to see. So perhaps it's part of that ecosystem as well, but a more efficient way of creating it. But this has been nodded to a bit, but behind these tools, of course, people like Sam Altman, the head of OpenAI, he gets the credit and his face on the Time magazine cover, etc. But behind these tools are actually many, many people that do the labour of labelling the data so it can be accurately read by the machine, people doing the training, these systems. I mean, Tracy, I wonder how you think about this labour and how we can make it more visible if it should be, because if we're going to use these tools in the creative process, again, it may look like there's one author at the end who wrote the prompt that generates the image or the writing, but in fact, there's a lot of writers behind it.
This is something that both Kate and Richard address in their fabulous books as well, and it infuriated me researching Man Made, that there is an enormous workforce in places like Kenya that sit there and label images that are violent, that are pornographic. So in the West, our eyes don't have to see them when we get on the internet. There is a widening of the gap between rich and poor because the tech giants have profit margins larger than nation states. Governments aren't keeping up up with regulation or legislation. And honestly, a lot of these places in developing countries are like the modern day salt mines. And often it's modern day slavery. They don't get paid anything at all. But even worse, get this, I was talking to someone from Microsoft a couple of months ago, and he said, yeah, we've stuffed up, you know, with the bias and discrimination, all that kind of stuff. He said, but we're moving into the era of machine teaching instead of machine learning. I said, what are you talking about?
Been heading there a long time.
Heading there a long time. He said, well, you know, you now have the power to train the machines because they go out in their beta version. And now we're expected to teach ChatGPT and Midjourney to not be racist, sexist and bigoted. And that is more unpaid labour that we're expected to do. They're putting out imperfect products and we're expected to fix them for next to nothing. So, yeah, the tension between the global north and the global south in this conversation, where all of the profits go to Silicon Valley and all the work is done in the global south, is only going to widen and get worse unless governments finally do something about it.
Hi, Richard.
Would you mind if I just
go ahead.
Added something to that? I agree with all of that. About the exploitation, you know, the physical, the material exploitation of these people who mine the stuff as well on which we do these devices, you know, the mining, the making, the micro-tasking, I mean, just awful. You know those, you know, are you a robot things, you know, that's what they're doing all day, every day. Except, as you say, it's a lot more sinister. What you said about automation of education is, I think, true generally as well. The process of automation does not begin when the machines are installed on the factory floor. They begin when Frederick Taylor goes into a factory with his time and motion studies and says, well, this doesn't look right. We'll have one worker doing one job who can't hold it over the boss because they only have knowledge of that one job. So it's, you know, it's absolutely marbled into the question of power, this. The reason I think Cad and I disagree slightly is because I don't want a world in which those quote-unquote efficiencies are running the show, because I think that in fundamental ways they go against the grain of what I'm not embarrassed to call our human nature. And I would want to see, you know, kind of literary crowds and literary people in the vanguard of people who recognise that as people who are engaged in something which is irreducibly human, I think. You know, genre fiction, et cetera, notwithstanding. I think, you know, when you create a work of art, what you're doing, you know, is you're saying, either as an individual or as a culture, you know, here is an epiphany. I make a gift of it to the world, and it is a gift. You should see our advances. It is definitely a gift, right? Be grateful. Okay. And then it goes out into the world, and then somebody reads it, and then they have their own epiphanies. And then you come to places like this, and we compare notes, which are notes about what it means to be a human being. If we're proposing to get our art from systems which are in no sense human, which, as I say, are less like us than houseflies like us, then I think I don't want to be a complete Cassandra, because I'm not anti-technology. It doesn't make any sense to be anti-technology. Mm. We're a technological animal. The use of tools predates the emergence of Homo sapiens by 3 million years. But I think if we're going to get our art from these things, we're in some trouble.
Can I jump in? Because I think this is a question that's been consuming me, and I imagine the audience is having it too. How do we break the machine? You know, like, how do we either stop and say, I refuse, you know, go on a strike and say, I refuse to engage in the technology or works that have been created by it? Or do we rise up and break the machine, Richard?
Yeah, we need to, at the risk of trespassing on everybody else's time, just very quickly, I think you need to pull it back into the political space. So I got an email the other day from the president of the NTEU, who'd read something that I'd written in the Monthly about the ChatGPT thing. And she said, oh, thank you for it. We've got a working group on this. I mean, that's a good start. I'm going to write back to her and I'm going to say, you know, the union has to put some expectations around these new technologies, because every year, you know, it gets more and more automated. Eventually, they're going to bring the machines in and they say, but you wouldn't want to keep those jobs anyway. They're just terrible jobs. You know, why would you want to keep those jobs? You were miserable. You were always on stages complaining about your job. And they're awful, you know. You're working to templates. You've got Office 365, and you know, which Bill Gates gives us all free now if we work within the educational space, because apparently he's in charge of education now. You know, he's the guy you go to, right? And you've got Microsoft Teams, and you've got Zoom, and you've got all this other stuff. I know I sound like a dreadful old boomer, but I don't, you know, you need to pull it back into the political sphere and to say, is this the life you want? Do you want to live your life in front of a, not in front of a screen, for goodness sake, behind a screen, in front of the network? This is no way to be a human being.
Or with transhumanism as part of the machine.
Yeah, absolutely.
I was going to ask another question, but then we'll go to audience. So if people would like to, if you have a question for the panel, there's a mic just in the middle right here, and we'll come back in one moment. Kat, I wonder if you had anything you would want to add there, because I know your work straddles science fiction, but also you have, you're a digital rights activist yourself. So how do those two sort of parts of your working life give you a perspective on this question?
Yeah, I just want to welcome everyone to the digital rights space. I can feel everyone becoming radicalized. There are many ways that we can show our power in these spaces, and some of them are just linking arms and refusing to use tools that we think are unethical, and refusing this discourse of the inevitability of technology or techno-solutionism. Like, if there are problems in the world, then there's an app for that, and refusing those kind of discourses. And then this is where I think we can take inspiration from the Luddites. Luddite is used as a really derogatory term, but they were textile workers who saw machines taking their jobs away and literally smashed the machines. So I think this is a really cool opportunity to figure out what is our version of smashing the machines. And maybe it's going out to the desert where everyone holds their data centers and taking some mallets to them. I don't know. I'm just suggesting some options.
And the machines were taking their whole life worlds away, you know, because they were in control of the character and the pace of their production. And, you know, so it was a whole culture that disappeared, you know. Yeah, I think that's...
Do we have if you'd like to ask a question, there's a mic just here. And just a reminder, questions need to be questions. And I'm also told to remind people we have a zero tolerance to racism and disrespectful language. So respectful questions, please. Thank you.
Well, just looking for upsides, is it possible that AI could be good at teaching dying languages?
We touched on this, but Kat, if anything to add?
Look, I think this comes back to questions of for what purpose, like what is the use of language, what is the purpose of language? For coming from an Indigenous perspective, language is culture, language is country, language is our stories, it's our relationships to each other. A tool can't replace that. An algorithm can't learn language and then teach it. It creates a kind of an artifact or an artifice, but that is no, it's no substitute for connection to country and those relationships. So I'm skeptical.
Yes, go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Really interesting. I guess I was thinking about the role of the consumer or the reader. This is just a new area that I'm thinking about now. And if we wanted to vote with our own eyes and choose not to read creative works that have been had an intervention with ChatGPT or artificial intelligence, how can we even know? And I was just at the publishing workshop a bit earlier, and I was thinking, can you envisage a time when it won't just be perhaps a voluntary code of conduct by publishers where they'll actually make a disclaimer at the start that there has been ChatGPT or not or artificial intelligence involved? Or would there be a role for regulation? Because it's a bit like the GM debate. You want to know if there's genetically modified organisms in your food. You know, I want to know if the work I'm reading, there's been artificial intelligence used by the writer.
Anyone?
I know that Tracy and I are both with the same publisher. In The Hummingbird Effect, we put a disclaimer at the front. I mean, it's a very, very small proportion of the book, I will hasten to add, but to say that parts of it had been created using ChatGPT. And I think, Tracy, with yours, it's the cover.
Exactly. We created the cover using Midjourney. And incidentally, on the bias piece, and then I'll go to the central tenet of your question, I wanted a strong robot woman looking to the future with concern but hope. What we got with the prompts we used, which were very benign prompts actually, the words we put in to create the image, was a highly sexualized gold robot woman with a tiny waist, massive boobs, and huge biceps, because that's how it read, strong woman, huge biceps. In any case, we put on the cover this image is AI generated, and that's the way it's heading globally, fortunately, with the EU's terrific AI Act, which can be used as a template all around the world. We're seeing watermarking on a lot more images and videos. It's not perfect, but it's there, and I think we'll see that more in books as well. With regards to the first part of your question, though, I loved it, because we forget that as consumers and members of civil society, we have power. We can contact our local member and say, we want this to be an issue that you focus on. We want regulation and legislation to protect people's rights and their jobs. And as consumers, you know, don't catch an Uber. That company has the worst toxic culture. Catch a Shiba or a taxi. Those poor drivers lost their jobs when Uber came in. There's a lot of things that we can do, and we forget we have that power.
Next question.
Thank you, Richard King. I really enjoyed your book.
Thank you.
I've never used any social media. I certainly not used any chat bot stuff. I'm quite content. My question to the panel is, why is it so hard for people to ditch social media?
Oh. Oh, God.
May I?
Go ahead.
Well, the answer that you'll get generally is that it's addictive. But saying it's addictive doesn't tell you very much, because people aren't addicted to the social media platforms any more than the heroin user is addicted to the powdery substance that is heroin. What they're addicted to are the feelings afforded by the stimulus. And the feelings afforded by this stimulus, which is to say the social media, are about connection with others. So the reason we find it hard to get off social media is because we are, I don't want to use this word because it's so Silicon Valley, but we are hardwired to seek out the community of others. The trouble with the kind of sociality that you get through social media is that it's a morbid form of sociality. It's not the kind of sociality that a human being needs in order to flourish, which is an embodied sociality. More or less, that's why we come to places like this and we don't just do it over a screen, okay? But what happens on social media is that all of our communications with one another are pulled into this reputational, performative economy of likes, posts, retweets, whatever it happens to be, and whether we know it or not, we are anxiously curating it all the time, okay? So that's why I think social media is so hard to get off. I do disagree with some of my comrades on the left, however, when they say, well, social media would be fine if you just didn't have capitalists in charge of it, because you'd still be left with the problem of what is essentially a virtual sociality. Mm. And human beings don't do well in that space. They need to be together, face-to-face, you know, we need to build proper communities, proper material communities. That's kind of the basis of the whole left-wing moment in history.
So another thing that's kind of troubling about the fact that a lot of social media spaces have been scraped for these tools is that they're not scraping, if we were to allow that we wanted something like ChatGPT and we wanted it to speak in a human-like manner, that would be one thing, but it's not really being trained on normal human dialogue face-to-face. It's being trained on our most performative selves or most discordant selves, the kind of material that's on Reddit or on Twitter or on Facebook. So another that
can I just add to that as well? I think it's important because there's so many writers in the audience too, that social media, like many other systems of power, and I wrote a lot about this in the book, is now a way in which we have to work and do our labour. So like Richard spoke to, our advances and our incomes in this country as creatives are not enough for us to live on. And one of the ways that our publishers and the people who employ us want us to work is often using social media. So it is, you know, there is an inevitability in a way, and you can absolutely opt out. But for many people, that's not a choice. For many creatives, they have to also make their income in this way. So I think that's just important to add.
In media too, for journalism, for sure.
If I can add before we go to another
Kat, go ahead.
Sorry, I just wanted to, because I think that's important. It's not just an addictive tool. These social media companies, these big tech companies have captured spaces on the internet where people live, where they connect to their families and friends, where they work, and there aren't meaningful options to distance yourself from a lot of those tools. It's where people do their activism, where they organise. So opting out of those spaces often comes at an enormous individual cost.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very true.
Go ahead, please.
Yes, my two-part question. One, I understood there was some select committee of the Federal Parliament somewhere looking at AI. I might be wrong, but if you know anything about it, wouldn't mind an update on it. And secondly, there was a reference given by an earlier commentator here about writing to your local MP and things of this nature. Having been a former MP many years ago, I can advise you that the best form is to terrorise them, make them fearful as to how AI could be used against them in general elections, would cost them their job. And I point to getting allies such as, dare I say, News Corp and others, as you saw with respect to getting Meta and money off Google and so forth, even though they're ratting on it. At the end, the politicians of all stripes couldn't hold the line against the Murdochs and other interested groups within the publishing industry. So use fear.
Oh, I love that. I checked on where the federal government was up to yesterday, actually, because I was curious. In December last year, I think it was, the Science Minister, Ed Husic, came out with some draft legislation and guidelines that honestly is like slapping people with a wet lettuce leaf. It was ridiculous, and I got very angry again. And then he announced a couple of weeks ago the composition of the round table, the group of experts that were going to inform the next iteration of this. He's got a lot of good experts in there, but my concern, because I'm interested in the bias and discrimination piece, is that they're all going to follow the American example and the whole free market, let's have voluntary regulation, which, as we know with big tobacco, does not work. So that's why I lean on, you know, contact your local MP, and thank you for that point. Use any kind of tool you can, because we can't trust the governments to do it on their own.
Are you worried, though, about potentially, if we use the government piece, the government is very interested, as the question asker mentioned, things that might affect them. So deep fakes in the political context, a video that shows Albanese saying something he didn't say and it becomes a news cycle, it misleads, questions about AI-generated disinformation. But is it, should we also be worried that that will skew the regulation in one direction when we need to be looking much more expansively? Cad or Richard?
I think that the best regulation is kind of tech agnostic. Tech moves a lot faster than legislation, but I do think that there is an opportunity both in, say, like the Copyright Act, new responsible AI legislation, even the Privacy Act as mechanisms for reeling in some of these tools and some of these companies. But I think I will take that on notice to harass your MP and think about the ways that you can instill fear in politicians.
Hi, I was wondering if the panel had any thoughts about the impact of AI and the movement away from artists connecting with people who seek out their art, and what kind of an impact that may have on the mental health of our community, given that we've seen a rapid rise in mental health issues after the COVID isolation. Did people have any thoughts?
It's a connection between between the readers and the authors, and just to understand your question, sorry.
Sorry, just as if we're moving away from the concept of art being generated by human beings to art being generated by machines, that connectivity, which I think is the healing aspect of art, which is a human connecting with another human, what happens to our mental health if we actually make machines the arbiters of our creativity or attempts?
Yeah. Thanks. I think it's a really good question. I mean, I would argue that one of the reasons we have a growing mental health crisis is because of the number of devices that we're now obliged, as you know, to be part of this culture, to you know, be around all the time. But this is why I say I don't have an answer. I mean, I think in answer to your question, it would have a bad effect on people's mental health. But this is why I say that. The beginning of wisdom has to be that art is a human pursuit, and it exists in all cultures. It's a human thing. Other animals don't have it, so far as we know. I mean, whales have their song and all that sort of stuff. But you know, generally speaking, when we talk about art, we're talking about a human pursuit. So anything that takes us away from one another, I think, is going to have an effect on our mental health. I'm working with an artist myself at the moment, a brilliant man called Simon Gilby, who reached out to me after he read Here Be Monsters, and this is exactly how he thinks it. You know, he wants the art to be in people's embodied space. You know, that for him is what it's all about. So I think it's a really good thing to consider. Yeah.
We have time for one more.
Sorry, I just got a question on diversity and inclusivity. How do we increase that? While I agree with, you know, the beta releases, it's all free work, but having that wider range of people, would that increase, like, improve our data sets, basically? So I think my question is, given the people that work in the industries that are creating these machines, can only cover so much and only have their own interest and what they see there. How do we increase diversity and inclusivity into the designs and building them?
There's a couple of really good examples that I think answer your question. One is the development of an automated AI light sensor soap dispenser that went throughout Marriott hotels around the world. In 2017, a Nigerian tech worker tried to use it and it didn't work for his hands, but it worked for his white colleagues and it worked for a white piece of paper. How did that happen? It was created by four young white men in Silicon Valley, and with innovations and startups, they tested on themselves. There's no such thing as inclusive design. What we need is something akin to the development of the Braille system. The wonderful director of the Centre for Inclusive Design in Sydney, Dr. Manisha Armin, tells a story about how countless people tried to create something like Braille, but they were all sighted. It was a waste of time, money and labour. It took someone with a sight impairment to create Braille, one of the greatest innovations of humanity, really. So we need inclusive design from the get-go, not only in the tech sector, but with the people who use this technology. I'm 56. As we get older, the research shows we use technology less, and therefore our likes, our interests, our diverse cohort is not being included in the next generation of apps and innovations. You've absolutely nailed it. Inclusive design is the solution.
Can I add?
Yes, go ahead.
Because I think there is a seduction in diversity and inclusion, and especially when it comes to increasing the diversity of data sets. We're talking about using these tools in creative ways, but ultimately the money comes from defense contracts for a lot of these companies. So these tools, while they do have these like fun creative outputs, are ultimately like intertwined with the military industrial complex. So when we talk about like improving the or reducing bias or improving the diversity of data, we need to ask for what purpose, because a lot of the time it's like, yes, one day people are better able to use automatic soap dispensers, but at the same time, it's how to do people better target people of colour in another country in ways that we don't see.
Well, thanks so much to our panel today. Thanks so much for being with us. And a reminder too that the books are available just over here, so please support our authors by purchasing one. But thanks to you all.
And thank you, Ariel.